The story of humans asked, why are we the most special of them all? And we kept answering, we're the smartest. The smartest. But others are braver, more beautiful, better singers. Everyone is extraordinary.
Mother, why is it this hard to understand?
What was in your mouth, was in your stomach, was in you. It's part of you now. If mother made it with love, if flesh tastes like care, how can you give that up? We are all children, and home is so hard to find.
For everyone.
So many homes are burning now. Some are flooding. We can't live in this house anymore, this tiny human house. The wild things are coming in. Wild, wild things.
This is Beyond Species, a podcast exploring issues around speciesism and the struggle to dismantle it. In this episode, we hear from Just Wondering, a collective of three individuals based in Eastern Europe, Em, Mina, and Aaron. They make animated videos which they describe as inescapably political and speculative. I picked some of the videos that had really piqued my interest, an impossible choice really, as the topics covered by Just Wondering cover so much ground, from Tim Morton's hyper-objects to Sonora Taylor's disability liberation approach. A liberation movement must change the narrative, and storytelling is Just Wondering's strength. We hear about their learning journey through the theory and how the collective came to make videos, as well as details about the illustration and animation process. We also hear briefly about some of the collective's plans for the future. First up, we hear from Em, who introduces us to Just Wondering.
Hi, Steve, and thank you so much for hosting us. It's so great to be on Beyond Species, because actually we've been listening to Beyond Species, I think from the beginning, and we really loved it, and we listened to almost, well, not the latest, but almost all of your episodes. So it's just really great. We've learned a lot from you, and thank you so much for doing this. So Just Wondering actually started with Mina and Aaron in about 2016, and they started doing short animated video essays on issues they thought it was really important to get them to a broader audience. And we really stay with this thought all along. To us, getting like more complicated ideas to a broader audience is what is really important. And then, you know, the ideas changed as we changed, and what ideas we found important and what ideas we wanted to bring forth, that was, you know, what started to drive us towards anti-speciesism, I mean. I think, you know, we had one breakpoint when we really started to be concerned about the climate crisis with the Anthropocene video. And then from that on, we started to think more deeply about, you know, how nature is constituted, and then about the species distinction and how that is constructed. And all of this really became something we became deeply invested in and wanted to research. Also even outside Just Wondering and within Just Wondering, and through all of the things that we were doing. So it was, you know, research, even, you know, academic research, so to say, looking into philosophy and sociology and anthropology, but also visual research, artistic research, just thinking in also in the narrative form, how can we get all of these theories that we were thinking through, how can we get them, you know, in a shape that might be more accessible for some audiences rather than others, because of course there is no such thing as universal accessibility, no matter how much we would maybe dream about that. So, you know, what we do, it's that we create these short animated essays, and from the concept to the final details, it's just the three of us, but we also collaborate with people as much as we can. Because, for example, Mina does the illustrations and the artistic and the visual drive, and Aaron ties everything together. And me, I also do the research and I do the writing. But, you know, we don't have anybody that is really good with music composition, for example. And it's like, it's always great to find collaborators and, you know, do things together, because, of course, we do not know everything and we cannot, I cannot think through everything and cannot create everything. It's just better to collaborate if we can. So, yeah, so we're like a collective of three individuals. We are actually located in Romania in Eastern Europe. Maybe this is not obvious, but like if you listen to our accents, you can tell it's not the UK. Yeah, and basically this is us. Thank you. We coexist with human life forms, non-human life forms, and non-life forms on the insides of a series of gigantic entities with whom we also coexist. The ecosystem, biosphere, climate, planet, solar system.
There isn't any away anymore, as Timothy Morton puts it. The idea of a world has cheapened, because other beings have worlds too. And because there isn't a one-size-fits-all world dimension to rule, the end of the world is not the end of everything. It is an end of that matter, of that stuff that sits in a space for humans to colonize. It is a dead of distance. The blank space that can be manipulated smoothly is exactly what is disappearing. It is an end of endings.
I asked Aaron to expand on the philosophical concept of object-oriented ontology, particularly with regard to Timothy Morton's hyperobjects and agri-logistics. Aaron, do you think animal agriculture could be considered a hyperobject? And is agri-logistics really just another way of understanding the relentless appetite of colonization and capitalism? Also, how does object-oriented ontology help to decenter the human, or at least reduce human exceptionalism?
Thank you so much for the question, Steve. Animal agriculture is certainly a hyperobject in my opinion. Actually, one of the worst hyperobjects that have ever existed is the animal industrial complex. It spans from the agricultural sector to zoos and labs. It includes the economic, cultural, and social dimensions. It has an enormous global impact. The animal industrial complex consists of markets, producers, consumers, slaughterhouses, states, fast food chains, for example, and entire industries built around taking the flesh of other animals, dismembering them into countless pieces that are used in almost all products we can think of. Kristin Meindertsma researched and tracked all the products made from a dissected pig named 05049. 185 products were found to be made from this individual. 05049 was transformed into food, photo paper, train brakes, car paint, ammunition, soaps, cigarettes, washing powder, anything we can think of. When Timothy Morton talks about the concept of hyperobjects, they describe how tricky and hard it is to point to these massive objects. The animal industrial complex is everywhere, and so are its effects. Think of pandemics, from COVID-19 to African swine fever, or the unimaginable vast areas of forests that are cut and burned down to create pasture land for grazing cattle or to clear the way for soy. Almost all of which is going to animals confined in factory farms. In the Amazon, for example, 96% of the soy produce is going to animals that are exploited for human consumption. There is an interminable list of effects. Water degradation, biodiversity loss, coral reef destruction, and many other devastating effects in people's lives. People who have to deal with the toxins of this horrible industry, with disabling environments and the catastrophic climate crisis. These are just some of the ways through which the massive hyperobject acts. The animal industrial complex is not entirely traceable and visible, which in object-oriented terminology means that it withdraws. For example, if we were to study all the psychological effects it has on non-human animals, all the lives it touched, how humanity uses the body parts of other animals, ingesting them, or painting with colors containing bone fat from pigs, the list will never end, and still the hyperobject will not be rendered fully. This is because even if we will trace all the billions of animals killed in a day, and know how their transformed bodies are being used by humans every day, we will still not feel their suffering. We will not know how it is to be raised for one's flesh. Timothy Morton is telling us that hyperobjects loom over innumerable beings and are massively distributed in time and space, but they are never fully graspable. Animal agriculture can be traced back to the moment when humans started capturing and confining other animals, controlling their reproduction for human use, but which largely benefited powerful elites. However, from the moment Europeans sought to colonize other parts of the world to the Industrial Revolution and our present moment of global capitalism, things changed drastically. In the last 200 years, agricultural practices and animal slaughter intensified to an entirely different scale. Farms were transformed into factories whose intensive practices were supported with tax breaks and subsidies. The animal industrial complex was born. So when did the horrifying animal agriculture become what it is today? Well, it's hard to say. Timothy Morton's concept of agrilogistics describes an ongoing process that started 12,000 years ago with the agricultural revolution. A loop, an algorithm, a technical and logical way to build up space. This is how it is described. In their words, it is the smoking gun behind the literally smoking gun that is causing a mass extinction event. Agrilogistics is the logistics of a particular agricultural mode by which the human is separated from the non-human, and space is arranged in a smooth, functioning, and instrumental way to become manipulable. Agrilogistics makes the world look solid, rigid, and stable, making up a simplified version of the world available just for humans. But the world is much stranger than this. There is no nature with capital N. Object-oriented ontology challenges both these common prejudices as well as deeply anthropocentric views about reality. Many philosophers have described the human-world relation both as something in which we are forever caught and as something entirely different from anything else, granting it a privileged status and ending up focusing exclusively on human language. In object-oriented ontology, this correlation is reduced at its minimum, and it becomes part of a world where other such correlations exist. So what does this all mean? Well, all beings have indirect but equally valid access to reality. Humans cannot be granted a superior ontological status. Not only that the dogs and the cat living with me have a relation with the world, but so do the ants and the trees. Neither me nor Arya the cat can exhaust what is real. Neither one of us can grasp other entities fully, directly. Even when fire burns cotton, to use Graham Harman's example, it only makes contact with the flammability of the material. It does not interact with its odor or its color. All entities withdraw, so there's a difference between how something appears and what it is. Now, although this philosophical theory was not meant as a social and political critique and is not committed to the same scholarly activist work as the field of critical animal studies is, for example, there's something extremely powerful about it that challenges human exceptionalism by addressing our epistemic violence. Throughout history, Western philosophy has been eager to say that theory cuts deeper than practice, that thinking penetrates reality as nothing else. In object-oriented ontology, however, thinking a tree, smelling a tree, or touching a tree are not that different, since neither one of them can exhaust the real tree. Thinking is an act, and not only the thinking subject does not grasp the object entirely, but it is also grasped by other beings. So what the theory is opposing is exactly the modern dichotomies we are so accustomed to, such as mind-body, nature-culture, or subject-object, and speaks of everyday entities without making reductive or universal claims about them. One of its goals is to criticize what Graham Harman calls ontotaxonomy, from ontology, the study of being as such, and taxonomy, the science of classification. While medieval philosophy offered a privileged status to God, Harman argues that modern philosophy has shifted this status towards the human, creating a categorical split between human and non-human beings and their products. One category is imbued with creativity, freedom, the possibility of being an active agent that shapes the world. The other is passive, reserved, mechanical, determined, lacking what the other category has. So why is this theory important? Well, One obvious problem, in my opinion, with human supremacy and anthropocentric values is human arrogance, that somehow, deep down, at the ontological level, we have a superior or special place among other beings, that we can go meta, that we can penetrate the deepest level of reality like no other being. Object-oriented ontology simply shows that nothing else could be farther from the truth than these claims are.
Man is pure fiction.
The human is not a fixed identity on the other side of nature. The human is certainly not whiter or more masculine. The human doesn't have a specific essence to point to. That doesn't pave the way to racism and speciesism.
Let the future speak.
Let the moral failures speak. Human nature is not superior, nor is it determined by one thing only. It is a lack of power, of imagination lurking behind what it means to be human. A lack of direction and will to question the current status quo.
The construction of the human is political. Often in the animal liberation movement, we talk about the human-animal division or binary. But I don't think we dig deep enough into how this works. Aaron, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on how this division is created and enforced. And how do we dissolve this division and move towards plurality of being and celebration of differences?
So let me start by saying that the human-animal binary is defended from at least three points: an ontological one, a biological or evolutionary one, and a normative or political one. Recent literature has criticized the human-animal distinction on all these scales. My point of view is that the biggest problem is political, and then ontological, both having primarily to do with modern Europeans. From an evolutionary perspective, no biologist will deny that humans are animals. And very few people will disagree on this, given sufficient biological understanding. Although some models of seeing other animal species can be more problematic than others, for example, a gradual or discontinuous understanding of the theory of evolution will be inclined to say that humans evolved from an inferior animal condition, attempting sometimes to define the human identity as qualitatively different from the rest of the animal kingdom. These views reinforce the humanistic notion of animality as a category separated and classified in opposition to the human, or defined as being less complex, unique, and thus inferior in status. However, there's also a pluralistic understanding that highlights a more subjective interpretation of life. In this view, the purely physical environment in which animals live is just a portion of a bigger subjective environment. Evolutionarily speaking, humans specialize to be the kind of beings they are through an adaptive process where our own subjectivity is a particular animal expression. As Roberto Marchesini points out so well, humans are specific animals. Of course, with certain traits and characteristics, but they are not more special than any other animal. Thus, contrary to the humanistic claims, evolution doesn't have a telos, an end goal. Humans did not evolve from the animal condition, but are the very expression of a particular animal. When it comes to the ontological problem, it is often assumed that there is some kind of privileged position that humans have in the world. The distinction between nature and culture, which is a modern classification, also plays a role in emphasizing the existence of a gap between humans and other animals. This dichotomy rests on the assumption that it is only humans who have culture, and it is often seen as something that comes on top of nature. All of the other animals are entirely part of nature in this view. Thus, the human is seen as a free and creative agent with a unique response to the world, while non-human animals are seen as being determined in a mechanical fashion, either by their exterior environment or by their interior so-called instincts. Nature, in this humanistic understanding, is a dull and predictable background for human history, culture, and expression. The dichotomies that are present in modern times, the ones that I've mentioned before, nature, culture, human, animal, mind, body, are related and were, and often still are, taken for granted as common sense even by various disciplines. Throughout history, Western philosophy has, with a few exceptions, done a terrible job thinking about other animals, assigning them a lower status and using them as a prop from which to define the human. Classifying other animals as machines, or arguing that humans have a more privileged access to reality, are just some of the ways in which European philosophers sought to separate humans from other animals. However, as it became more and more obvious in recent times, to argue that humans have some sort of privileged position in the world is more often a theological and anthropocentric prejudice than something that can be seriously defended ontologically. Given that the human-animal distinction lacks empirical evidence, and it can no longer be supported ontologically, we are left with the hardest problem, the political one. From this point of view, it's obvious that maintaining the separation has a clear instrumental value to humans. After all, the entire fabric of human societies is shaped by our exploitation of non-human animals. And it is this history of enslaving and breeding other animals for human purposes, that shape how much our societies value a pig's life today. The violence of species is happening at an intersubjective, institutional, or epistemic level, for example, has much more to do with this history of exploitation than it has to do with how humans conceive other animals. Behind the animal-industrial complex is not simply an irrational belief, but a long and brutal process from which our human societies had something to gain. This in return made other animals' lives less and less valuable, giving humans more reasons to distinct themselves even further from other beings, which came to be seen as natural resources. There's no doubt about the powerful interest behind the subjugation of non-human animals, both by those who fill their pockets killing other animals for their flesh, or by the larger society benefiting one way or another from the ongoing exploitation. But there are other political defenses for the human-animal dichotomy. For example, in many instances, even those who hold progressive views today refuse to think of themselves or other humans as animal beings. In most cases, this is completely understandable, given how many people were thrown into the category of animality so as to be made inferior and thus exploitable. However, for us as political anti-speciesists and post-humanists, we cannot argue that humanity is this safe space from dehumanization and animalization, since it is precisely by creating the animal, the savage, or the uncivilized other as a category to differentiate oneself from that white Europeans declare their humanity. The problem isn't that the moral circle isn't large enough, or that throughout history Homo sapiens were categorized as animals, but that Europeans defined the human in their own image to distinguish themselves from other beings they had an interest in exploiting. The violence consists of constructing those who resemble our own image and share our own way of life superior, while waging a total war towards everyone else who falls outside. There are some ways to tackle the human-animal distinction, in my view. For example, Matthew Calarco argues for recognizing a zone of indistinction between humans and other animals, emphasizing our vulnerable lives as bodied beings, looking at our shared similarities as animal beings, without denying that every individual, as well as every species, has distinct characteristics. Another way is to lift the category of animality from its inferior status given by the humanist paradigm, as Roberto Marchesini argues for. Humans share similar pressures with other species. Non-human animals are not aliens to us, but neighbors. The very condition of animality consists of being a vulnerable, feeling creature with a subjective understanding of the world. Animality in this sense is seen as a creative response to the world and as an expression of subjectivity, not as the absence of individuality, desires, and interests. Another way might be to start seeing other animals as political actors. Like Donaldson and Kimlicka argues, human or non-human, one can be a citizen or a denizen or part of a sovereign community. Being recognized institutionally as a member of society, having both negative and positive rights, as well as the possibility to choose what kind of life to have, can challenge the human-animal hierarchy, reconfiguring our public spaces and the public good entirely. Have you ever tried to count, listen to, or look at an entire truck of chickens packed for slaughter, paid attention to every individual life, or given them an ounce of your time?
Working to complete a large painting of a truck crowded with chickens, Taylor realized farmed animals are bred to be disabled. Their disabilities, or super abilities, are selected to better cater to the market. In the meat industry, chickens are bred for their huge breast, which causes skeletal malformation. In the egg industry, chickens are bred to lay hundreds of eggs a year, as opposed to their normal dozen, which causes reproductive problems.
In this capitalist economy, and probably in any other anthropocentric, growth-based economy, animal disability is profitable and desirable. Yet, if you were to abolish such consumption, how would these non-humans live, given that they, at least partially, depend on humans for survival?
Ableism, sexism, racism, and other oppressions are linked to the oppression of animals, speciesism. Aaron, what are your thoughts on how some of the issues around oppressions connect and interact with speciesism? How does ableism, in particular, play its part in animal agriculture, and how might we challenge this?
Hierarchy, in my opinion, is a useful term here to think of these interconnected issues, since all of these problems stem from different social systems that are built around domination and oppression. The social hierarchies that are present today are traceable to various historical processes, periods, and occasions. The agricultural revolution, for example, led to the domestication of non-human animals. The division of labor in a class society, hierarchical and patriarchal relations are strongly related to these early nomadic pastoralist societies in which a man's status was determined by the number of captive animals he controlled. Colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade, on the other hand, lead to the rise of industrial capitalism, giving birth to the intensive, huge slaughterhouses of today. In exchange, the endless growth of modern economies, with their massive intensification of agriculture, burning fossil fuels for even bigger profits, while satisfying the growing needs of the West and the rising populations, growing from 2 billion to almost 8 billion in the last 19 years, led to the large-scale human impacts. This, in turn, has set in motion a new geological period that is boiling up an even bigger catastrophe. The sixth mass extinction, undergoing as we speak, is already affecting both non-human animals, who are caught up in wildfires, burning alive to death, as well as marginalized communities, facing disabling environments, toxins, poor living conditions, environmental races, floods, hurricanes, all kinds of crises. From the moment non-human animals were domesticated to the European colonization and the present-day reality of neoliberalism and global capitalism, we can see that many oppressive relations and social issues are linked and often caused by similar pressures. Pandemics, environmental degradation, social inequalities, and the oppression of non-human animals are strongly related. For example, the most recent critiques of humanism and of the Enlightenment values have pointed out that the white, Eurocentric, able-bodied cis men portrayed as universal and as a model of an ideal subject played a role in creating various outgroups. This happened through a process of differentiation, where various beings and their identities are portrayed as less worthy of ethical and political consideration by the actors in power and on the basis that they have or lack a specific characteristic. Women, black, brown, indigenous, people of color, non-human animals, all have been reduced to a lower status throughout history. However, while the struggles of working-class people, women, and racialized minorities were on the left's agenda, slaughtered and dismembered non-human animals rarely became part of the left's social movements for liberation. John Sanbonmatsu points out that the left, with a few exceptions, has historically viewed human violence towards other beings with indifference. This is not a surprise, since much of left's intellectual heritage, as with liberalism, is also traceable back to the Enlightenment period. When it comes to animal issues and politics, leftists are often as much stuck in humanism and anthropocentric values as everyone else. However, things are changing and have been changing for quite some time. Ecofeminists have long stressed the need to include other animals in our social justice struggles. Vegan anarchists and critical animal studies scholars have been arguing for quite some time for total liberation. Political anti-speciesists of Italian theory also sought to link social justice issues and anti-capitalist struggles with animal questions, issues and politics. Disability justice and feminist critiques, on the other hand, offered many links of resistance against capitalism's desire to profit off bodies. Sonora Taylor has long stressed how other animals are being raised to be disabled, since this is what makes their bodies profitable on the market. So, while it is not that rare anymore to hear someone arguing that issues of bodily autonomy affect other animals, not just humans, or to problematize our anthropocentric norms and practices, among other social issues, it's less easy to see real structural changes that breaks up these existing norms to change our relations of exploitation. And there's no clear path to achieve this faster. But there are tons of things that can help and are worth doing every day, some of which can move things in a better direction.
So, I'm not a scholar of disability, but I can say for certain that reading Sonora Taylor's book, Beasts of Burden, was a sort of stepping stone to changing how I see a lot of things and how we see a lot of things, I think. So, suddenly, disability just became really visible to me the way species was already visible. And both together started making more sense of how the world orders who is worthy and who isn't worthy. So when we did the video on disability and animal liberation, we were a bit worried, I think, that the video might get the wrong kind of attention, but it didn't. Which is interestingly also what Sonora Taylor also said once about her book. It just turns out that most people end up engaging with it, do so with great care. So really what I think about, when I think about her book, I think one of the really important concepts to grasp is dependency and how dependency is complicated, and it's an important concept to think in relation to disability. Because Sonora says that dependency has been used to justify slavery, patriarchy, imperialism, colonization, and disability oppression. She says that it's like this rhetorical tool, that it's used to sound compassionate and like you're helping, while at the same time you continue to exploit those you are concerned about. So this is helpful in thinking about many movements and many of our relationships. And I think it's, like she says, also really helpful in thinking about our relationships to other animals. Because, you know, sometimes exploiting, especially farmed animals, is somehow justified through this tool of dependency. Because if they are dependent on us, and to a degree they are, then this is used as a sort of argument in saying that, well, we can also get something from them because they get something from us. So she really shows how this is, this thinking shouldn't work like this. And she shows how through a disability perspective, you can actually look at interdependence and realize that everybody is in a sort of spectrum of dependency throughout their lives. You know, when we are babies, we are very dependent on other people, human babies and the babies of other species. So dependency is something that we go through, and it should not ever be used to justify any kind of oppression. And you know, the second thing is, of course, the ability, the thing about the ability and how, you know, exploiting other animals is sometimes justified because they are considered to have, you know, not the abilities that humans have. So, and the abilities that they have are considered less worthy. And this is an argument that is sometimes made, you know, to disconsider people with disabilities in some ways, as if they were less worthy because they are less able. And obviously, this is just wrong, and this is it should never work like that. And for example, then, you know, Daniel Solomon, who writes on neurodivergence, really expands on this in the topic of, you know, thinking of how minds work differently for humans and within the human species and outside the human species. So there is a privileging of a certain kind of neurotypical human mind. And Daniel Solomon then shows that this is sort of structure that privileges the neurotypical human mind is oppressive towards humans and towards other animals. And he really shows this through a few examples, the way society patronizes both autists and non-human animals, the way society looks down and does not treat them as equals in a certain sense. So the way they are expected to conform to neurotypical standards, like the way neurodivergents are expected to conform to neurotypical society, and the way non-human animals, if they behave in some ways that are too aggressive or, considered just dangerous to humans, they might be put down just for that reason. So they really, make this point of drawing these lines that are not just looking at how humans and non-humans are oppressed, but also looking at what kind of thinking, what kind of structure creates the oppression. And I think this is really important on many levels, not just because it's better activism, but it's just a better understanding of what is going on. So I think sometimes it feels like, there's a push to connect all oppressions because it feels like this is the good thing to do. But, reading F. Cole, a Black vegan theorist, it really made me realize that a strong reason to think oppressions together is because that's really how they occur. And then they don't happen separately. They stand on each other and they reinforce each other. So animal agriculture disables the animals it kills, but it also disables the workers and the surrounding community. It pollutes the environment, which further creates vulnerability and health issues for everyone, human and non. So speciesism and ableism stand on each other. They both operate on the basis that a certain ability to do or think in a particular way is relevant to determine someone's worth. Animals are suffering because of ableism, and disabled humans are suffering because of how they are perceived to be somewhat less, and in a sense, sometimes even animalized. So as Sunara Taylor points out, and I quote, "To call someone an animal is to render them a being to whom one does not have responsibilities, a being that can be shamelessly objectified." So studying how oppressions connect and construct one another is, I think, very important to the work of liberation, to disentangle ourselves from them and to just go forward.
This is a story between a mother, a daughter, and a world. Put your headphones on and let it unfold.
Mother, whom are we eating this evening?
It is the wheat, the water and the sunlight of tomatoes and herbs, the labor of people who plucked them from the earth and brought them to the table, the labor of worms who fertilized the soil, the labor of trees, the labor of science, the labor of coal, of economy, of gender, our labor.
I think one of the keys to really push animal liberation, in fact, liberation for everyone, let's say multi-species liberation, forward, is to change the narrative. We need to tell stories that capture the imagination and move the conversation forward. Just Wondering's strength is storytelling. Their videos draw you in and open doors you might not have noticed before. I wanted to hear more from Em about writing and storytelling. How do we tell stories for earthly survival?
So, first of all, we tell stories. We acknowledge their importance. So I used to be a little worried about storytelling with theory because some writers prefer to think of stories as, good, beautiful, aesthetic. So they're stories for a reason, not philosophy. But I've grown out of that because the stories that help me survive are the ones that have a sort of, seed within them that help me rethink and revalue and embody myself better and be in the world. They're not just beautiful and they don't just reproduce the status quo. And I think we need anti-speciesist stories and queer stories, feminist stories, anti-capitalist stories, because theory enters the story whether you put it there consciously or not. So I'll talk shortly about three of our videos, Voicemail to the Hungry Epoch, We Fly, We Crawl, We Swim, and The Wild Things Are Coming, from which the excerpt was. So Voicemail to the Hungry Epoch was inspired by the Besna theater production Vinovată, which is Romanian for guilty. And this play impacted me greatly when I saw it in the winter of 2018. It's one of the less researched texts that we have, but it's also really inspired by this very political play. And we were just delighted to have Oana Pușcatu voice it, because it was her incredible performance in the play that made it get stuck in my head. So Vinovată is a one-woman show which confronts the climate crisis, and it has added center issues of social justice. And if you ever get to Bucharest, do see it. It might still be running. So I think voicemail was already getting us in the new direction we were going in. Voicemail was the video we made after the video with the Anthropocene, which we were already going into the a more ecological and less anthropocentric direction. But also visually, the style, our style changed a bit. We had more abstract environments and sometimes fewer colors. And interestingly, I remember correctly, I wrote voicemail in one sitting, and there were three versions to choose from. But let me skip to something that's very much based on research, and that is our short animated video from that premiered this year in 2021. It's called We Fly, We Crawl, We Swim, and it's a short film about climate justice from an anti-speciesist lens. And initially, we got the Culture and Animals Foundation to do it, and we thought we would be doing a video essay that was supposed to be 10 minutes. And as we started researching, we just realized that, you know, there's so much to go through, and there is maybe a better way to tell this story. So it turned out to be a 23-minute short film that at the beginning we didn't know we were going to make. And I also remember, you know, we read a lot research-wise. It was very much influenced by Eva Meyer's writing on animal languages and very much influenced by Donaldson and Kimlicka's thinking around the political theory of animal rights and their book Zoopolis. But then, of course, we really engaged with the climate justice and environmental justice literature and the literature from political ecology. We kept some of the things we already knew, like some stuff from Timothy Morton, but then we also engaged with David Niebuhr's animal oppression and how it interrelates with capitalism and then with colonialism. So it was this really big, complex thing that towards the end, we were really trying to look at the multi-species justice framework, and the things that were being written were, you know, or the things that we found were like really... they were from 2019, so the literature is, I think, pretty fresh on this one. And I think we had this big chunk of theory that we had written together, and then I tried to make it into a more narrative form, but the first one didn't work so well. And then we had this second format in which there was the voice of the human and the voice of justice, and this one stuck. And I'm glad it does. I think it works pretty well. And the third one, The Wild Things Are Coming. I wrote this in August 2019, and I remember reading those three books that influenced it and being so amazed by them. Actually, one of them is not a book. It's Val Plamut's text on being prey. It's really short, and I really recommend it because it's absolutely amazing. And then the other book that I found really interesting at that time was Katia's The Lives of Animals. And I just soaked this information at that time. And wait, there was the other book, Vincent Desprez's What Would Animals Say If We Asked the Right Question? This is, again, it's just such a creative book about animals. I definitely recommend this one as well. And then I just stayed with these books in my head. And then the story came out, which is this conversation between a mother and a daughter. And I think it came out, in the summer sometime, but we didn't know how to animate it for a long time, which is why the final video only was put out in the spring of 2020. Because we know we decided it's better if it get out at all than just wait until we have like a whole team to do frame by frame animation or whatever, which, you know, who knows when that might happen. And besides, we had the opportunity to collaborate with two amazing artists from the Circular Studio. So we said, okay, we'll just rely more on the audio. And we also had this really lovely animation in the loop on a loop, which Mina actually worked a lot on it, because frame by frame animation isn't easy. So I think what's interesting about this one and just about telling stories in general, especially when you have it done collaboratively or through mediums, is that, you know, when we recorded, I think at some point during production, time started passing through the story. And I remember it, is that we made it so that the daughter is young at the beginning and then they both get older. And this wasn't originally intended when I just wrote it. And I really love this, love it when this happens in stories or in film, you know, when they take a life on their own and they just go on in their own directions. And this happens just by giving them your time and you know, giving them, letting them lead you in a certain sense. And they become something else. And sometimes that's, they become something better. So if I remember correctly, what really drove the style of that story was my obsession with seeing grace, like finding a way to be thankful for the food that we eat and for eating together that was non-religious, but could actually create a sort of feeling of gratitude. And I was really influenced by my Mary Oliver's poems in terms of style, especially the poem I Happen to Be Standing. And you will notice some of its rhythms are like hers. I mean, one line is almost a direct reference. So I really believe stories can tell what theory can't, but of course, theory can explain what stories cannot tell. I don't think they are in a conflict. And I think it would be interesting to think of storytelling with or for other animals. I don't know much about that, but, you know, just thinking, my first thought is goes to Michelle Westerlacher's multi-species designs. But even in stories, like if you think of stories as maybe actions through time, not just stories are words following one another. Maybe it might be possible. Who knows?
The animation in Just Wondering's videos is ethereal and otherworldly, yet also lucid and inviting. Mina, could you tell us more about the illustration process? What are some of the technical details? But also, how does the illustration add to the power of the words or move the story in different directions?
Well, these days, I think of illustration as a medium of communication, one that could inform the viewer with a particular specificity, or that is just another question from another angle. By this, I mean a possibility to translate the passages from our essays and stories into more graspable messages that could offer a different understanding. One that makes a deep jump into a dark space of open possibilities where a radical notion can coexist and shape one's thoughts. Making animation is such a long, tiresome, but also rewarding process in which you sometimes just end up moving objects one pixel up and down, looking over and over to see how every little piece ties up together. And sometimes, this also applies to illustration, which is just another middle step into the process. To go into technical details, and this differ from one video to another, and of course our available time for the production, we usually start by breaking down the script into visual keys and select what metaphor we can use to better depict each passage. Afterwards, moving on, depending on the style of the video, such as narrative story, hybrid video essay, or the Thinkers and Concepts series, we select some guiding styles as inspiration, and we connect them into a mood board that reflects the script's concept. I follow up this by my proposal of color palettes that inform the overall look and feel. And maybe afterwards, if time allows, we may be adding a storyboard to create a short visual narrative and separate each section into sketch scenes as a guiding draft somehow. And we're getting closer to the actual illustration, but first I have to take another round of picture references that becomes the base of each scene. Sometimes I use these images to offer a grounding and more material mimetic representation for the later subjects. Or just, it could be an idea to start thinking of how I can tie together the information and create a collage technique out of it. And for this, as a side note, working from an activist anti-speciesist position means embracing myself with the courage to look for the perspective of non-human animals into their suffering and the violence that happens to them, and actually illustrated in a way that people can bear to face, looking deep into their ways of living and dying. And I like to hope for more scenes when I can illustrate joy, just happy pigs swimming in water. That would be so great. As a second major part, the magic happens, and I illustrate every scene in more detail. Sometimes the magic seems to be locked away, I don't know, and I just need to practice more, learn and unlearn the ways in which I can offer a better visual story, usually assisted by the guidance of my partners. Although it seems like each of us does a specific part, our ways of working are deeply intertwined, entangled, because we always discuss everything together so we can assure all is depicted according to the visions we have. I like to call it magic because sometimes it seems like my hands are doing all the work, but actually behind, there's an ongoing process of exploration, thinking of, with and beyond the scenes, and a very tiny sprinkle of luck and love for the material aspect of working through your body. To get into the visual styles, I probably need to explain that illustration for us works in a two-way street. For one, we have the drawn, screen-recorded compositions that are behind the Thinkers and Concepts series. Here, after the previous steps that I just described, I try to put every information together in my head, imagining a mixed collage that reflects a larger paragraph, and afterwards I would draw everything in white on a black background. For contrast, we like to add two or more colors, maybe three, that add a visual reference to each video, distinguishing it from the others. We developed this style after the whiteboard animation techniques used in explanatory videos, to have a more serious approach in contrast to the notion that animation and illustration are just for a younger audience. But let's be honest, also it's just a lot quicker, and even if it still takes time. So the overall dark space, I think, adds more depth and also supports a larger contrast to most videos, essays available online, at least these days. So the second approach would be a mixed technique of drawn and constructed vectorial illustration, one that's used more in graphic design that works very well as a base for the two-dimensional animations we created in our previous videos, like the Anthropocene, voicemail, the humanist political. These techniques also respond to the software in which they occur, because every tool offers a specific type of representation that needs to be taken into account. Although this seems quite different as operation, most of them are created in a similar surreal style of representation, where we cannot point out time and space. This way, we can make use of this fantastical attribute of drawing and imagination by creating something more than real, something utopian for the future, and something soft. I call it soft because using a filter of illustration lessens the burden of actually watching heartbreaking live actions that can leave you with more than one nightmare. I've studied visual arts and sculpture for 8 years, and from previous experiences I know that making something look real creates a grounding effect of a placement, of existing as an anchor. This presence occupies an actual place and becomes a statement of representation. It creates an example, a sort of signpost that shows you the way it moves the antispecies talks a bit further, a bit deeper into the core, and to dismantle the human supremacy. Also, I think illustration has this power to make the abstract more real, and even to make the real into an abstract realm. As an artist, I'm deeply influenced by the surrealist paintings of Dali, by the minimalist abstract movement, land art and conceptual art, and lately by Hartmut Kiewert's paintings of animal utopias. I hope I didn't pronounce his name very wrong, and for that I'm sorry. I also think the digital environment had an influence over me by making me choose this bold, otherworldly color so particular to its reflection. And the traditional plastic art infuses my thoughts with an obsession of creating dynamic and moving compositions. At the same time, I know that visual arts need to acknowledge the fact that it is political and that it has the power to shape thoughts and actions. And precisely for this, illustration proves to be a perfect medium for creating inclusive spaces for humans and non-human animals and their interactions. It's also an accessible medium to use with minimal investments that allows an infinite space for mistakes and rethinkings, moving away in this manner from the elitist art environment where the only ones with proper knowledge can produce the great art. Our videos take a lot of space for research, and sometimes not all the concepts can just be put into words. And here illustration also works by depicting a subject that is more than its direct meaning, adding a layer of insight that comes only from having all the notions and theories combined. So I think illustration for us starts from a point of limitation to a fixed digital canvas, but it grows up step by step by including and forming all of our thoughts into visual strokes and movements. And hopefully, this will allow the viewer to make a stronger connection with the subject and accept its open possibilities of interpretation.
M, Aaron, Mina, thank you so much for your impactful videos so far. They presented such a wide breadth and depth of issues that need to be discussed much more, both within the animal liberation movement and beyond. I'd like to know what the future holds for Just Wondering. Where would you like to go next with the collective? And what are your hopes for the direction of the animal liberation movement?
So we don't know exactly for sure what the future will hold for us, for Just Wondering, but we still have some ongoing collaborations and we are still planning new video essays. So we have also been thinking about making a local anti-speciesist magazine. However, we haven't decided exactly how this is going to look like and who else will be involved in this kind of project. But we have been very inspired by this magazine from Italy called Liberazione. So I think if this project is going to happen, is going to be kind of similar with this magazine.
Yeah, so I think for now, at least the short future, it's quite established, as Aaron suggested. Regarding to the visual aspects of the video, I would love to have more time to expand on more techniques that we can use and maybe create some short fictional speculative animations.
So basically, we want to keep asking questions that are important to us and put all this effort in working together against all forms of oppression. This is what we are aiming towards with our videos. And yeah, I think this is what will drive us further.
So I think, as it is pretty obvious by now, that the animal liberation movement cannot stay in its own category, separate from the other liberation movements. But also, it must find ways to really take other animals into account as agents and listen to their voices and their wishes. So it's going to take, I think, a lot of passion and creativity and determination. Our hope is that this is going to happen. Like, you know, tiny lights, like the fire is spreading and the cities are flooding. So we will rise up to the task to find diverse ways to unmake the destruction that is to come. I've seen people optimistic about ending industrial animal farming maybe in our lifetimes. So I'm not sure if it will happen, but I do believe it's necessary for our collective survival. But of course, it's not just survival that we hope for. It's good lives, good multi-species lives with other animals as our kin and family. As we know, some of them already are.
I just wanted to say a big thank you to Just Wondering, Em, Mina, Aaron. Thank you so much for putting this together. And I thought a little explanation might be useful for the listeners to know how this came together, because it actually took quite a long time. And I had discovered the Just Wondering videos and really enjoyed them and found them so helpful. And the way that they are presented, some really complex philosophical topics, you know, made available for people within the animal liberation movement, but also people who aren't, can watch them and, you know, get an understanding of some of these really complex topics. So I was delighted when I got in touch with the collective and, you know, found out that they were listeners of the podcast and that they'd be pleased to be on it. But with the amount of projects, obviously, that Just Wondering are doing, finding the time for them to put this together, you know, took a bit of time. But also mainly it was me being slow, because it took me ages to get the initial questions over to them. And then it took me ages to edit some bits of audio to send. And, you know, it took me ages to follow some things up. So thanks for your patience. So we decided that instead of just like a one-to-one interview, a three-to-one interview, it would work quite nicely in this format of kind of segueing some audio clips from the videos, and then M, Mina and Aaron being able to answer, and then, you know, me sticking that all together. Actually, as it turned out, Aaron, I think, did most of the editing in the end, so thanks for that. Yeah, I've just really added the music in, beginning and end, pretty much. So thanks again for your awesome skills. But yeah, I just wanted to say that I think storytelling is so important. And one thing we really need to improve on, and, you know, it's not just the animal liberation movement, it's all movements, social movements need to get good at telling stories. And the thing is, you know, humans are natural storytellers, but I feel like our imaginations have kind of been, you know, restricted in lots of ways by the lifestyles we're forced to live and by the kind of inane rubbish that mainstream media throws at us. So it's just really refreshing to see, you know, these topics covered in this way and presented with beautiful illustration, beautiful animation that's kind of hypnotic to watch. It's just the whole package that Just Wondering come up with is just wonderful. And it's this, you know, this kind of storytelling that we need to be sharing with each other and developing using these stories. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, we're out there doing film screenings and we're saying, you know, watch Dominion, you know, trying to get people in a room to watch 2 hours of utter horror. And of course, there's some value in that. But imagine taking one of these short videos that Just Wondering have made and using that at a film screening instead, or a couple of them, and to get the conversation going. And it's something that people want to watch, and they're still getting the message about, you know, multi-species justice and animal liberation and the climate issues and all these other things that are in the videos. So I think really, you know, let's start using some of these stories in different ways in our advocacy. And so the Just Wondering videos are really a vital resource, I think. So check them out. Go on the YouTube. Check them out. They've got loads of videos now. In fact, the topics that I chose were from videos that are now older videos, because I think it was back in January this year that I kind of chose the videos, and it took me ages to get all this stuff over to them. But you'll see when you go on to their YouTube, there's like so much more stuff. So that just leaves me to say, once again, a big thank you to M, Aaron and Mina for bringing this all together. And I look forward to seeing what Just Wondering does in the future.